Shrink Wrap Radio number 420, a model for integrative mental health with Dr. Ruben Nyman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Ruben Nyman, PhD, whom I interviewed previously on episode number 302, Exploring Mindful Dreaming, as well as on episode number 256, Mindful Sleep, Mindful Dreams. Today, we'll be discussing his model for an integrative approach to mental health. For more information about Dr. Nyman, please see our show notes for this episode at shrinkwrapradio.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ruben Nyman, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, I'm happy to have you back on the show. I think I've had you on twice before, speaking about sleep and dreaming, and both of those interviews were based on books you've written, and today our focus will be a little different. And as far as I know, you haven't written a book on the topic yet, but you have been offering workshops on it, namely a model for integrative mental health.
Yes.
And you sent me a PowerPoint deck to kind of give me an idea of, you know, what your thinking has been. And having gone through that deck, I suspect the workshop may be a prelude to another book. Would I be right about that?
It's a possibility. I've got a couple of other books in the pipeline right now.
Oh, wow. So, yeah, because the deck that you sent looked like it'd make a great outline for a book.
You know, that slideshow came, well, if I can share just a little bit of history, the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, where I'm on the faculty, directed by Dr. Andrew Weil, sponsored an initial conference on integrative mental health about 4 years ago, 2010. And we had a much greater response than we anticipated. So this was an attempt on the part of Dr. Weil and the center to expand the focus of integrative medicine, integrative health, to basically to psychotherapists. And the response, as I said, was just phenomenal. Subsequently, Dr. Weil and I presented at the Networker Conference, a large psychotherapy conference on the East Coast, I think the next year. And he did a keynote address, and I did a day-long workshop. And again, the response was phenomenal. So there's a tremendous amount of thirst, of interest, I think, on the part of psychotherapists to better understand and actually use integrative approaches. And so that's where this slide deck came from. And I've been doing that presentation there since, and we'll probably do it in other places as well.
Yeah. Well, that's great. I have a number of psychotherapists that listen to the show and also a lot of psychotherapists in training. So you're going to have another audience for your ideas here. Let me start out by asking you, what's the problem that the integrative model for mental health seeks to address?
Well, in a word, it's segregation. You know, the word integrative, the opposite of integrative is segregative. And I actually had to look that up some time ago because I started writing it and wasn't even sure if it was a word because I hadn't heard it in speech or I don't think I've read it. But it is a word. And our current approach to health in general, mental health in particular, is actually significantly segregative. We split things apart. We certainly split the mind and the body. You know, there are two major camps in healthcare. There are those who take care of the body of the physical form. We call them physicians. And there are those who take care of the mind. We call them psychotherapists. And of course, there's a good deal of overlap in a number of arenas. But the basic message is that health is not something that's integrated. It's segregated. And we segregate professionals as well, and this is a critical issue. We have mental health professionals and we have physical, we don't call it that because we think of them as the health professionals.
Right.
But physicians have been saddled with the ultimate responsibility, you know, sort of the overview of health. So there's a segregation there too. And I think there are a lot of smaller ones when we begin to look at specialization and subspecialization. One example is I have a subspecialty, as you know, in sleep and dreams. Part of my approach to that, or a large part of my approach, I should say, is informed by an integrative approach. So when I do an evaluation and a treatment plan around sleeping and dreaming, I don't just look at data related to sleep and dreams. You know, how many hours are you sleeping? What are your behaviors before sleep? What are your cognitions around and so on? I actually ask about the whole person. I look at other psychological variables, clinical psychological variables, and I look at somatic issues, what's going on in your body. I look at health issues. I look at medications. Historically, I started practice 30 plus years ago in California, and I have a distinct memory of one of my colleagues who I have to say was a bit on the OCD side, but warning me in a caring manner that I might have been crossing the boundary into medical care at the time when I told him I had suggested that a patient have a cup of chamomile tea to calm them down before sleep.
Yeah.
In those days, and now the standards have changed quite a bit, thank God, but in those days, there was this, I know in my training and subsequent understanding of clinical psychological ethics, you know, we didn't practice medicine without a license, and simply suggesting that somebody take something by mouth was iffy.
Well, has that changed? I wasn't aware that that had changed.
It's changed to a degree. I think if you look at APA ethical standards, for example, around medications, back then, we as psychologists weren't even permitted to discuss medications. I mean, we could refer out. And I know there was a pretty dramatic change some years ago, which not only allowed but encouraged psychologists to provide information about psychiatric, psychotropic medications, which I think is critical because they don't often get sufficient information from prescribing physicians. But it has changed, and most therapists I talk to today are more open to that. They don't shy away as much as they used to from that sort of classical body-mind gap, which I refer to as the body-mind chasm.
Yeah, and that's an area I'd like to explore with you a little bit, because you're a psychologist, I'm a psychologist, and as you know, historically, there was some criticism and cautions and so on about the medical model, and now some people are concerned about the medicalization of psychological problems.
Yes.
And then there are questions of, what's the appropriate level of intervention? Should we be intervening at an educational level, at a medical level, at a molecular level, an atomic level, the brain? There are all these kinds of questions. And so speak to that, if you will.
Yeah, not to mention a spiritual level.
Oh, right. Yes, right.
I think to answer that most appropriately, we have to step back and ask ourselves, really, what are we trying to do? What's our major concern? And obviously, our concern is health. It's really difficult to segregate physical health from mental health. Over the years, we've seen more and more data showing profound links, inextricable links, for example, between mental psychiatric conditions like depression and heart disease, for example, depression and cancer, anxiety and cancer. Maybe we'll talk a little bit about this interesting parallel between autoimmune diseases and self-recrimination. So this is question of dualism, which I think many of us are familiar with as a philosophical and sometimes a spiritual question. You know, we have a body and we have a mind. And it's not just a spiritual question. It's a question that has some very practical ramifications. So science, and I think virtually all of us are strong believers in science. Science studies matter and manifestations of matter.
Yes.
The physical world. So health sciences focus on the physical body, on physiology, on biology. Biology is literally the study of life. So science looks at matter, but human experience, the human mind is a matter of mind, right? It's not matter. Human experience is psychological. We might say it's spiritual consciousness, that we've never really been able to find the link, hard as we try, between the physical and the psychological. We can find links between the physical and behavior. We can look at the brain and find correlations between neural networks, complex sets of neural networks lighting up that are associated with. But, you know, we have the old, this is a correlation, not a cause and effect. And so we look at this body-mind issue. The body and the mind are really flip sides of the same coin. Okay, and we can make an argument of monism, of non-dualism, and say, yes, they're really one. But the reality is, in our experience, in your experience, in my experience, in the experience of listeners, I have this body, but my experience of being alive is not physical. It's again, it's psychological, it's about consciousness, it's spiritual. And as much as we want to acknowledge of the connectedness, which I think is critical between body and mind, well, I think we have to continue to acknowledge that there are two different ways of looking at life. And they're both necessary, they're both essential. There's this old image, it's a little hard to depict vocally, but if you imagine a cone, you know, a three-dimensional cone, like an ice cream cone turned upside down.
Okay.
And you shine a light laterally onto a wall, the cone would project an image of a triangle.
Right.
If you shine the light vertically down on the cone to something below it, it would project the image of a circle. So I think this is one of the ways of understanding body and mind. If who we are as a whole is that cone, we get two very different shapes, two very different reflections. It throws off two very different shadows, and we need to honor them both. The problem, so we live in a world where the emphasis has been on the physical and the psychological, and I think many of us as psychologists understand this, has been valued, but it's a second class citizen in the world of healthcare. Physicians, and I mean this sort of philosophically, not referring to any particular specialty, physicians run healthcare. And then there's the sense that we as psychologists, if something is not clearly definable physically, physiologically, then the ball goes over into our court. So the presumption behind this is that the mind, that our psychology, that our consciousness is an epiphenomenon. It's an expression of the body. The body grows a brain, and the brain somehow grows consciousness. But we look at the body as being primary. The alternative to this, and again, this is sort of a psycho-spiritual argument, is that we can look at the body as an expression of consciousness. And many people would make that argument. I don't think we have to settle that argument, but I do think we have to reconsider the question of primacy. And we today, most of us, look at the body, at matter, as being what matters, physically. And I think a very key contribution to this issue here comes from Candace Pert, who sadly had passed away this year. She's probably best known for her research at Hopkins that laid the foundation for the development of SSRIs, for which, incidentally, she subsequently issued a public apology. But Candace did some incredible work toward the end of her life, basically around the theme of looking at the body as the unconscious mind. So rather than looking at the mind as an expression of the body, looking at the body as an expression of the unconscious mind. So what this does is it gives us an anchor on the psychological side to begin to build a bridge toward the biological side. There's been an anchor for a long time in biology and medicine, you know, and that's the brain. We look at the brain and we can tinker with various neural networks and neurochemicals and so on. And say, if we do this, we get this impact psychologically. So we need to, I think psychologists need to contribute to closing that gap, There'll always be a mind and a body side, but we need to close that gap. And I think this notion of looking at the body as the unconscious mind is an essential foundation for closing that gap.
Well, speaking of that gap, what is it that psychotherapists can do to help heal the body-mind gap?
Great question. I think part of this is a willingness to be courageous. So let me start by saying we need to, of course, operate within the scope of our competence. You know, we're trained in certain things, and some of us have more of a background in somatic therapies, body therapies, psychophysiological issues. Some of us have less. So we want to stay within the bounds of that. But I think we need to recognize that the people sitting in front of us come in with mental conditions, but they also have a body. You know, many years ago, there's a great book written for physicians called The Body Has a Head. And it was written by a doc who was very frustrated with the fact that human life was just being reduced to biology. And he was reminding doctors that psychology was a factor. We need a book, speaking of books, called The Head Has a Body. And so what psychotherapists can do is recognize that. And there are a number of specific ways in which that can be done. Let me use the example of depression. The World Health Organization is projecting that by 2030, that depression will be the number one health concern in the world, that more people will suffer from depression than any other illness. Now, is it psychological? Is it psychophysiological? You know, it has all kinds of roots in different directions. But we know we have really hard data now that shows, we have data showing that there are effective psychotherapeutic techniques. The most effective ones, in my understanding, are cognitive behavior techniques. But we also know that it's really difficult to successfully treat depression without addressing sleep issues. So I think all therapists, and I've said this before, need some basic background in sleep. We also know that there are a number of nutrients that play a critical role in depression. So any depressed client, a client patient, this is another issue to talk about, what do we call them? But any depressed individual I see, I ask a number of questions about their nutrition. I ask them about their intake of omega-3 fatty acids. Those fatty acids make up about a third of cell structure in the brain. So they're very, very critical to normal functioning. I ask about the intake of B vitamins. I absolutely focus on vitamin D, vitamin D3, because deficiency in all of these areas have been shown to lead to depression. And so I think we can't, in good faith, just do talk therapy, psychotherapy, whatever it is, even if there's a somatic component, without throwing a broader net and asking about these other things.
Now, going back to our earlier conversation about APA, Code of Ethics, et cetera, mm-hmm. loosening up and being very careful not to go beyond the scope of legal practice, would a person get into trouble advocating for more vitamin D3, more B vitamins, and so on? I think in the old days, they certainly would have. Has that changed?
Yeah. I think it's a question, when you say advocating, I think it's a question of how we present this. Mm-hmm. So number one, yes, we have to be careful. One simple example is that if you have a patient/client who is on a blood thinner, a Coumadin, warfarin, for example, they need to be cautious about omega-3 fatty acids, which also, fish oil, for example, which also can thin the blood. So I never prescribe, and I would not recommend to psychotherapists saying, hey, do this. I ask people about it. You know, when did you last have a physical? Did they check your vitamin D levels? Have they checked this? Did your doctor talk to you about omega-3 fatty acids? And then my focus is on the provision of information. Okay. I tell people, you know, we have really strong data showing low levels of vitamin D, which is an over-the-counter supplement, are associated with depression. Inevitably, at that point, my patients are pulling out a pad of paper and they begin to make notes. So again, this isn't the whole, this isn't a comprehensive treatment, but it's a critical part of treatment that's been left out.
Yeah, and I think in that slide deck that I saw, there was the implication that you feel that psychotherapists, non-medical psychotherapists, are maybe woefully deficient in their knowledge of the biomedical side of things.
Yeah, I think so. I think in some ways it's too easy to say, you know, well, that's a biomedical problem. You know, talk to your doc about that. Even if they are being treated, for example, for chronic pain, it's something we need to consider. So one of the I think, simple and major recommendations I make around integrative mental health is that we need to move from an interdisciplinary to a transdisciplinary perspective.
Yeah, what does that mean? What's the difference?
From the time I was quite young, the notion of interdisciplinary treatment has been around, you know, many decades now. And so, you know, this idea that we should integrate, we need to communicate with physicians, with nurses, with nutritionists, with physical therapists. You know, if we're treating somebody that's also getting that kind of treatment, we need to communicate. But I think that hasn't worked. I think it's been a step in a very positive direction. But a transdisciplinary approach basically says we need to overlap in order to prevent cracks. You know, we talk about people falling through the cracks, and many do. We really need to overlap. So as a psychologist, I need to know a fair amount about biomedicine. I can't just presume that the physician will take care of all of that. And physicians need to learn, I think, significantly more about psychology and psychotherapy. So it's transdisciplinary. And I think over time, and something I envision into the future, that our primary identities will shift from being a psychologist or a clinical psychologist or some sort of subspecialty in psychology or medicine. My hope would be that our primary identity would be as healers, and then our subspecialty might be physician with this or that focus, or psychology with this or that focus. That, you know, these disciplinary definitions are really in place to serve professionals more than they are to serve our patients.
Yeah, what are the implications for costs of what you're discussing? You know that for a long time the physicians were primary, as you said, psychologists were secondary, psychology fought for reimbursement, and there are limits to what is reimbursable and what is not. And still, the costs of healthcare just seem to be spiraling, and if you will, more and more camels want to get their nose under the tent, that is, people who consider themselves plying one healing modality or another. So I know this is something that you've studied. Talk a little bit about costs and what can be done about those.
You know, around that topic, Dr. Weil has many times said and written that he thinks that the American healthcare system, even if we can call it a system, will collapse. It is collapsing under its own weight. And it's a critical issue. You know, health costs are the primary cause of bankruptcy in the United States. And we're seeing a pretty significant rise year after year. And I think without any significant benefits, you know, I mean, there's some things we do quite well. Emergency medicine is an example. You know, if you're having, if you've had an accident or having an acute medical condition, a heart attack, for example, there's no better place to be than in an emergency room in a good American hospital. But in terms of caring for chronic conditions, and certainly in terms of prevention, we really are lagging behind. And part of this is, I think, goes back to the notion that we see matter, we see biology, we see biomedicine as being primary in healthcare. And so the focus is on the physical with insufficient regard for the psychological. And one of the corollaries of that is that we think we can manage our health with physical substances, in other words, with medications. So we're very heavy-handed with medications in our world. And, you know, a lot of physicians are as frustrated as people in general and as psychologists are with what many of us believe are or is an overuse, an overdependence on medication. But, you know, it's derived from the contemporary medical model, the belief that we can tweak, we can suppress. Let me just go down a side road here.
Sure.
So the if we see the body as being primary and not the mind, we focus on what health psychologists have called disease rather than illness. So disease is the objective measure of being sick. Okay, so you can count white blood cells, or you can take somebody's temperature. There are numerous ways, numerous ways of quantifying somebody being sick, and it's objective. You know, it's observable or reobservable. Illness and health psychology refers to the subjective experience of being sick. It's not feeling well. And we've known for many years that the two don't correlate really nicely. So, for example, some years ago, data showed that about 50% of people who showed up for outpatient physician visits, for primary care visits, for example, had illness. They didn't feel well, but there was no detectable disease. Now, we could argue that it was prodromal, it was preclinical, there's something going on that's not yet observable, but I think not, and maybe in some cases. I think that this is just a reflection of psychology not being integrated well with biology. You know, there are some cross-cultural medical anthropological studies that look at the occurrence of disease without illness, which I find fascinating. So in other cultures, people might have symptoms. In subcultures, for example, it's not all that uncommon to lose your sight, actually go blind, legally blind as you age. And it's not considered a disease in that culture. There's a classic scene in the movie, Mel Brooks' movie, Young Frankenstein. I don't know if you've seen that.
I've seen it, but it's been a long time.
So Igor, played by Marty Feldman, Igor, the hunchback,
yes,
is hobbling along, and the good Dr. Frankenstein says to him, you know, I don't mean to boast, but I'm a great surgeon, and maybe I can do something about your hump. And, you know, he's this great hunchback. And Feldman looks at him with this great big one eye and says, "What hump?"
Right.
You know, it's an example of here's obvious disease, but there was no illness associated with it. So I'm sort of losing my train of thought.
That's okay. I've got plenty of questions for you.
Yeah, we were talking about cost. I think one of the reasons costs are so high is that we're trying to address everything as if the body is primary. And, you know, my bias, and maybe it's sort of obvious, is that there's a whole lot more that we can do as psychologists in terms of not just an adjunct in treating disease, you know, via illness and directly, but also in preventing it.
One of the things that you suggested that kind of struck me as strange at first was you said we should consider an energy medicine framework for thinking about an integrative approach to mental health. So tell us what that means.
Yeah, if I may, I think I shared this model with you previously, but when I teach about this, I refer to something I learned from my mother as a little boy. And that's when I was a boy, and if I wasn't feeling well, she would always come at me with three questions, always the same three questions. And this was her. My mother was an Eastern European woman raised in a little village, so this was sort of a local folk diagnostic Eastern European Jewish assessment.
Okay.
She would ask three questions, and the first question was, "Did you eat?"
Right.
You know, classic Jewish mother stuff, and If we look at this in broader nutritional terms, it's a question not only about the intake of food and fluids, which of course are critical to health, but it's a question about everything else we might consume. So we consume food and fluids, but in addition, we also consume energy in other ways. We consume vast amounts of information.
Mm-hmm.
You know, very few people would argue with that today. There's one blogger who suggested that in an average month, we consume more information than people did in a lifetime 100 years ago. Now, that's not measurable, but it makes a poetic point that I think is critical.
But the point has also been made in relation to advertising and how many ads we're exposed to in a day. And that is measurable, and it's fairly astounding.
Yeah, tremendous amount of information. We also consume light. And this is something people don't think about, but there are light receptors, obviously, in the back of the eye and the retina. There are also light-type receptors in other parts of the body. They've been identified behind the knees, and I think over time we'll recognize that skin also consumes light. And we probably consume other non-visible kinds of electromagnetic radiation. But we know that light and its absence, darkness, has a profound effect on our health, on circadian rhythms. So we consume food, we consume information, we consume light, and we also consume oxygen.
Yes.
The point has been made about food that the irony in our world is that we overconsume food, but we're simultaneously undernourished. And of course, that is the result of consuming poor quality food, a lot of food without nutrient value, high glycemic carbs, for example. We can make the same point about information, that we consume a lot of maybe titillating but junk information. I would make the point about light that we overconsume light at night in our world. There's no question about that. There's a Buteyko model, which I won't go into in detail, based on the work of a Russian physician, that argues that we actually overconsume oxygen, we overbreathe. So the point I want to make here is that we can understand health in terms of a flow of energy. All of these things, food and fluids and light and information and oxygen, they all can be translated into energy. And I think we're a bit of an energy crazy culture today, that there's this uncanny parallel between the global energy crisis, you know, we're running out of energy, and what I think of as personal or individual energy crises, that people often have insufficient energy. And by the way, oil is the number one traded commodity in the world, and the number two traded commodity is coffee. And they're both about mediating energy. So from a psychological standpoint, I think many of us crave energy. A lot of New Age spirituality sort of looks at energy as an expression of the divine. You know, I'm going to spiritually plug into, it's almost like there's this power plant in the sky, right? And I'm going to sizzle with divine energy and manifest money and parking spaces and love and other good things. I think there's an overvaluation of energy. But this is a model that allows us to understand the flow of energy and health. So again, first question, what did you eat? What are you consuming? Mm-hmm. My mother's second question was, did you poop? So we can just jump right to the metaphor here. Yeah. If did you eat is about what are you consuming, this is such a critical question. It's a question about what are we able to let go of. So if we are consuming energy, are we able to express it, to use it, or to dispense with it, to disperse it if we don't need it? And I think this is a very critical issue in understanding sleep disorders, particularly insomnia, because we take on more than we need. We take on more energy than we need. We become hyper aroused, and it's more than we're able to let go of. I think this consumption of excessive energy is one way of understanding, from the psychological, from the mind perspective, chronic inflammation. And as we know, you know, I think as psychotherapists, psychologists, we really need to have a better understanding of chronic inflammation, of excessive energy. Chronic inflammation appears to be a factor underpinning all major illnesses. you know, so we see chronic inflammatory conditions behind cardiovascular disease. We see it in neurodegenerative disorders, autoimmune diseases like arthritis, metabolic disorders like diabetes. We see it in cancers. We see chronic inflammation and depression, chronic depression, and then anxiety as well. So again, when we look closely at it, it can get complicated. You know, the immune system goes awry and it engages in friendly fire, and this causes an inflammatory response. There's actually an interesting cytokine theory now of depression that says that there's a particular immune response that's elevated that results in a slight increase in body temperature, which may or may not qualify as a fever, but it's a factor, a key factor in depression. So we can move toward a common language, a language of energy medicine. Now, the term energy medicine is something we use in integrative medicine. We have physicians who are specializing in this area. It's a way of understanding alternative medical systems like homeopathy, traditional Chinese medicine, and acupuncture, things like Reiki. We need new language, broader language that bridges body and mind. But I also think it's a really critical language that psychologists can use, that we can look at, step back, and look at the flow of energy in a patient's life. You know, what are you consuming energy-wise? Maybe in terms of food, maybe in terms of excessive exposure to stimulating information, other things like that. And we can understand that excessive information is associated with chronic inflammation.
And then what about the elimination part of it?
Great question. Oh, by the way, my mother's third question was, did you sleep? Yeah. So I think that's really important. And did you poop? How are you eliminating? So first of all, there's another silent epidemic aside from hypertension that we hear very little about in our culture. It fascinates me, and that's constipation. I don't have the numbers in front of me, but there are millions of people who chronically suffer from constipation. From an energy medicine standpoint, it's associated with a kind of holding, if you will. You know, and this is an understanding too in classical sort of psychoanalytic or psychodynamic theory around toilet training, you know, that there's a retentiveness. So there's a kind of holding, but that holding can apply not only to the movement of food and fluids through our system, but also the movement of various kinds of energy. So there's this question, and I think this comes up a whole lot in psychotherapy, a question about letting go. You know, often in chronic grievous situations, for example, people are unable to let go. This notion of letting go is a key. It's a key factor in all 12-step programs. There's so much discussion of the need to surrender. And I think, again, it's language differently in different schools of psychotherapy, but I think it is addressed in virtually every approach to psychotherapy. And so we can focus on, we can look at both excessive consumption and the particular ways in which people engage in that, and specifically, as it relates to that individual, how we might encourage people to both let go of excessive energy, and I think even more challenging is to encourage people not to consume excessive energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's very provocative, thought-provoking, what you're saying, and interesting that you mentioned 12-step, because I was immediately thinking of, well, maybe addiction itself is a kind of hanging on to something that one needs to be able to let go of.
Yeah.
Now, a lot of what you're talking about has the implication that that lifestyle is involved here, for better or for worse.
Yeah.
And so what do we know about how lifestyle affects mental health? We know it impacts our physical health, and we're hearing it a lot in the news about obesity in this country, and that's a lifestyle issue. Yeah. What about our mental health?
Well, so let me comment this. Let me back up a step.
Sure.
So some years ago, so 20 years ago, so I went to see my primary care physician, who he for a long time has no longer been my physician. And I had a physical, and everything was fine. And he was in a hurry as usual. And he ran out the door, and then came back, he opened the door, he stuck his head in, and I'll never forget, he looked at me and he said, "Hey, do something about your stress." Tone of voice, and then he left. And it's like I wanted to say, "Oh my God, of course, brilliant. Yes, I will do something about my stress." Like, what the hell do you mean do something about your stress, you know? But, you know, in all fairness to him.
Well, plus his method of delivery sounded like he was pretty stressed and a stressful way of delivering it.
In all fairness to Docs, you know, so he's got about 7 minutes to deal with me. He's, you know, got 60 people to see that day. And so we know beyond a doubt that lifestyle is a critical factor in health and illness. Now, that's not to say there aren't genetic factors and other things, but lifestyle, my sense is perhaps the most critical factor, certainly the most critical overlooked factor. And physicians are getting this now more than ever, but their hands are tied in two ways. Number one, they don't have the time to address lifestyle issue in a meaningful way. And number two, they don't know how. They're just not trained in this. Now, in our program, there's a lot of emphasis, for example, on motivational interviewing. It's been fascinating in the 12 or so years I've been teaching at the program. I'm always taken by the fact that the docs who come in to do our fellowship training, the vast majority of them come out with a profound regard for psychology. They get so interested in personal, in mind factors, in psychological factors, in hypnotherapy, and motivational interview. They were so hungry for this. And I think one of the critical factors in the evolution of integrative medicine is from the start, from decades ago, Andy Weil was unusual as a physician in that he had this intense personal regard for psychology, for the mind, for spirit. So I think this is an area, again, where we need a transdisciplinary approach. As it stands today, we, psychologists, psychotherapists, are in an ideal, an essential position. It's really, I think, incumbent upon us to address lifestyle issues.
Remind me of motivational interviewing. I actually interviewed somebody about that a long time ago, but how would you characterize the essence of that approach?
It's a technique, a set of techniques that evolved originally around dealing with people with addiction, specifically, I think, with alcoholism. It's a non sort of patriarchal technique. It doesn't go in and say, "Huh, you know, you're an alcoholic, go to a 12-step program." It's an approach to interviewing that I think is informed largely by a tremendous respect for the client. There are questions about, you know, would you prefer this or prefer that? So it has an old Rogerian sort of a client-centered focus, mm-hmm. and there's a good deal of data on it that shows it's effective, and it can be used in other areas too. So again, rather than in sort of a classical physician manner offering prescriptions, you know, do this, take that, it more elicits a positive response than it does impose one.
Yeah, so it's a non-blaming one.
Yes,
that highlights choice and the role of choice for the person. Would that be right?
Absolutely. You know, and this reminds me of one of the key tenets in integrative medicine is that healing is seen as a partnership between the professional, the clinician, and the patient. And you know, in some ways, this would seem to be so obvious, but it's often not looked at that way. You know, many of us go to the physician. It's as if we're bringing our car in for body work. We're bringing our body in, and they examine that and make recommendations, and we get it done. But there's that disconnect between body and mind. This is an approach. This is a tenet in integrative medicine that says we really include the patient, the client, as a partner in this process. You know, it's non-patriarchal.
You have some other tenets, too, that you listed in that presentation. I don't know if you can bring any others up off the top of your head.
Yeah. What I'd like to do, let me translate them into the tenets for integrative mental health, if I may.
Sure.
So focus on the more important ones. One of them, one very critical one, is a belief in endogenous healing, And this is something that is key to integrative medicine. There's this question that Don Meichenbaum addressed this many years ago. So when we sit down in front of a client or a patient, there's this unconscious process inside the therapist about who is this person? You know, when I look at this individual, you know, am I seeing a biological entity with a complex brain, again, with neural networks firing or looping or getting stuck? Am I seeing some sort of poor soul who's still engaged in unresolved childhood conflicts and wounds, you know, psychodynamically? Am I seeing a spiritual being? Really a lot of that is probably projection. What I believe fundamentally about who I am as a human being is likely what I believe and what I will project others, whether or not I say that. And, you know, these old studies going back some years that found that if a patient stuck with a psychotherapist over a period of time, that the patient's values, their moral values would come to align with the therapist, I think is profound. I also think there's an unspoken message we give to the people we work with about our beliefs, about what it means to be human. So in medicine today, the belief is that the body is something that needs to be harnessed and controlled and directed, that, you know, essentially you can't trust it. You need to tweak it. You know, you need to apply this medication if you get this symptom. We talk a lot in integrative medicine about symptom suppressive therapies in conventional medicine. One example, a great example is somebody gets a fever. And, if it's a child or an adult, your doc might suggest you take aspirin or acetaminophen. And the presumption there is that a fever is a sign of some sort of illness. Well, more technically, a fever may reflect the presence of illness, but a fever per se is a sign of endogenous healing. It's really the body's response to that. And it's so interesting that we really don't make that distinction well. I think this may be as true in psychotherapy. We often fail to distinguish a sign, a serious sign of illness, from a sign that the body or mind is trying to heal itself. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of depression, and depression is a broad term, so not all of it, but I think a lot of depression is actually, I think of it as a psychological fever that has a positive a benefit that, if we listen to our depression, there have been studies on this too. If you ask depressed people what they really want, is they want to rest, you know, and rest, of course, is a four-letter word in our culture. And, you know, it's like they want to get off the assembly line. And so I think there's a way of listening to depression. Depressed people also get fatigue. Fatigue, if it is respected, is associated with an increase in waking dream, sort of a spontaneous unconscious process. So the tenet here, going back to the tenet, is a deeper regard for the endogenous healing capacity of the body. In other words, having more faith in ourselves. And I think a lot of people who show up with medical or psychological concerns have lost faith in their own body and their own mind to heal. And I believe, after doing this work for years, that the body and the mind are hell-bent on healing, and that a big part of healing, again, it goes back to this notion, is we need to partner with, not impose or try to force healing on the body, but we need to partner with it.
Yeah, I've been very interested in shamanism, and as an approach within a certain communal context that seems to work to engage that capacity for self-healing.
Yeah, and I really like that communal notion too. And one of the issues in integrative medicine is that we expand beyond the body. We recognize that the body has a mind, and that the mind typically lives in a social, a cultural setting, an environment, and all of that comes to play. My spiritual mentor, Hugh Prather, once wrote that to some small degree, he said, all death is both suicide and murder. And it seems like a shocking statement, but I think it's a recognition of our place in a larger system, that there are dynamics within us which will eventually take us down. We will age and we will stop functioning. There are dynamics in the world around us that will wear and tear on us and eventually take us down. And I think recognizing that you know, both health and illness may manifest in a particular individual, but they're really properties of a larger system. This is also another tenet of integrative medicine.
Yeah. And, you know, years back, there was a big push for community mental health centers. Mm. And I'm under the impression that that movement faltered. Yet I have the impression that the idea of community is important in your approach. And we were talking about lifestyle, and it can be really hard to change your, quotes, your lifestyle, the things that you do habitually that you're used to and you're comfortable with. And maybe one of the key things that makes that possible is if you join a community of other people who help to support that.
Absolutely. I think this is one of the many critical lessons we see in the 12-step movement. The community is incredibly powerful. It works both ways. You know, there's interesting public health and medical anthropological data that looks at social contagion. So we know, for example, if your neighbor is overweight, it somewhat increases the risk of your being overweight. If your close friends, even if they're hundreds of miles away, are overweight, you have an increased risk for obesity. So there are mechanisms at play here that we don't quite understand, but they're quite profound socially.
Yeah. Now, earlier we were talking about, I've lost my thought here, but there was something that ties into something that you discuss, which is the role or importance of suffering. And so I believe somewhere in your presentation, you were, I guess this relates to the self-healing, the endogenous healing. Mm-hmm. And does suffering have a role, a positive role as well? I mean, we hate suffering, mm-hmm. but is there a flip side to suffering?
Well, I like the distinction offered in some of the Buddhist traditions between suffering, between pain and suffering. And for them, pain is inevitable. It's an inevitable part of life, both physical and psychological pain. There are, you know, so-called necessary losses, right? But suffering results from a kind of clinging to the pain, a holding, a constriction around it. Now, that may be true. For example, I learned years ago from a meditation teacher that most of us, when we're walking around, and I do this regularly, we stub our toe, you know, in a doorway or somewhere. Sure. If you look at that in slow motion, many of us at that point will turn toward the toe and hurl expletives at it. You know, damn. And that's a kind of constriction. And what this man, Stephen Levine, used to teach was to embrace, in that moment, to embrace the pain compassionately. So you would minimize the suffering in doing that. And what I found, and you know, at least subjectively, is that it's a lot less disturbing to just experience the pain without projecting all kinds of suffering on it. It's a lot better. So yes, pain is inevitable, but suffering, as they say, is optional.
Maybe related to this is something you discuss as a healthy way of being sick. Mm-hmm. What are you getting at there?
Yeah. So we go back to this distinction between disease versus illness. And illness is the subjective experience of being sick. Disease is the objective experience. Over the years, I've had a handful of patients, some who were quite ill and passed away, some who've been chronically ill. I'm thinking of one or two right now. A young woman I work with who's had a chronic autoimmune condition, is in and out of a lot of pain. But she has this resilience about her. And it's not that she doesn't have pain and sometimes suffering, but you know, it's as if she has a deeply embedded sense that there's something even more important than health in her life. And so this takes me back to something I grew up with, many of us grew up with, you know, with my Jewish mother and all the mishpucha. And that's there's an old saying, you should only be healthy. You should only be healthy, right? I hear this from lots of people, actually. In fact, about 10, 15 years ago, I sponsored a conference called The Jewish Perspective on Healing. You should only be healthy. So, and I used to believe that. And now I think it's a misunderstanding that our goal is not just to be healthy. You know, being healthy is like having a really good car. Okay, you have a vehicle. Your body, your mind is a vehicle, and it can take you somewhere. But it's not an end in and of itself. So there are people who can be sick, who can have disease or illness. But again, I'm thinking of this one particular individual who has this profound, I'm not sure what word to use, this passion about life. She has an incredible sense of humor. And again, this woman is in as much chronic pain as I've ever seen anybody be in. And you know, it's a struggle for her. But she comes up for air very frequently. She's got a really strong social network. She has an interest in sort of personal artistic expression. So there's something much more important in her life than being sick or being healthy. Not that that's unimportant at all, but she uses the vehicle she has. She has a higher purpose, if you will. And I think that's the essence of being sick in a healthy way. You know, in our world today, there's so much emphasis on staying healthy. But not enough emphasis on why we should stay healthy. You know, what's the reason for that?
Someone pointed out, and I don't remember who, that the world is mostly being run by people who don't feel very well.
Yeah. That's Winston Churchill.
Okay, I thought it might be him, but I wasn't sure.
Most of the world's work is done by people who don't feel very well. I was thinking of Joe Campbell, you know, who said, you know, basically that it's not that we're so much looking for meaning as we are for experience. And I think we're caught in this sort of body is primacy. We're caught in this social definition of what's meaningful. It's meaningful to be healthy. So here's an example. We confuse medical metrics with true experience. So a lot of people will, when you know, you ask them about their health, I have patients who do this, they'll come in and they'll bring me their numbers, right?
Yeah, right.
Here's my cholesterol, here's the number of hours I sleep at night, you know, if they're sick, my white count did this. And those numbers, somehow the metrics become meaningful. And they're just measures of physical health, not of personal experience. And I love that Campbell quote, that it's really about finding the experience. That experience is mental, it's psychological, it's psycho-spiritual. It's not about the body. And the body may be in good shape or bad shape, but people can still have that kind of meaningful experience. They can be healthy.
Yeah. And you said that you don't think that the war metaphor is very helpful. Mm-hmm. We talk about the war on cancer and the war on AIDS and so on.
Yeah. This goes back to this faith and endogenous capacity to heal and partnership. And medicine has become a war. You know, we fight germs. We go to battle with symptoms. We kill germs. In 1972, the United States Congress met, and literally, these are the terms they used, they declared war against cancer. And cancer is a great example because it's a little bit like a medical Vietnam. It's really hard to distinguish who the enemy is. Mm. And it turns out over the years, for example, we until recent years, we believed basically that germs were terrible. I grew up in an era where, you know, everybody was afraid of germs. And, you know, you were spraying and eating and doing things to get rid of germs. And it turns out that these things we call germs, that many, if not most of them, are actually incredibly beneficial. You know, they make up a big part of who we are. They line our gut, and they're critical to our health, our digestion. They create nutrients and so on. So it's not so simple. And I think we need to stop shooting at anything that moves in a weird way in our body. This is particularly true in my work around sleep. So many people go to war with their insomnia, with their sleeplessness, and they're firing rounds of alcohol and pot and sleeping pills. You know, it's like damn it, I'm going to get this thing. It's as if it's an enemy. The reality is that so much of what we call disease is really health that's gone awry. And I made the point earlier that often we confuse a sign of endogenous healing with a sign of disease. So one example is that, you know, being up in the middle of the night is not necessarily a symptom of insomnia. We're in a world today where this warring attitude has led many people to believe that if they wake up to pee at night, they have insomnia. And that fear in and of itself can cause them to spin out cognitively. They get anxious, then they can't get back to sleep, and it can lead to insomnia. So I really think we need to come at this in a nonviolent way. I sometimes think about what I think of as a dialogical therapy between the body and the mind. If the body is the unconscious mind, what we're trying to help people do around health is open a conversation, you know, create parity and have a conversation between your mind and your body. For many of us, it's about controlling the crap out of the body, right? You know, we're going to ride this thing. We're going to ride it into the ground. We're going to tame it. You know, we're going to domesticate it. We're going to make it do what we want. We're going to push it. We're going to cut it short on sleep. We over-discipline the body. But I think good therapy, a good integrative approach to psychotherapy is really about respecting, a deeper respect for the intelligence in the body, and creating an open dialogue, a conversation between what's going on in the body and what's going on in the mind.
You know what? I think that is a great close for today. So I was going to invite you to, you know, did you have anything you wanted to say to wrap it up? But I think you just gave us a great wrap up.
Great. Thank you.
So, Dr. Reuben Nyman, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio, and I do expect to have you back more in the future.
Be my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm so glad I remembered to get back to Dr. Reuben Nyman. He had mentioned to me at the end of our last interview, more than 2 years ago, that he'd be happy to come back and speak about integrative mental health. So I'm glad I tagged that in my brain, because he's always such a knowledgeable and authoritative guest. I can see why Dr. Andrew Weil has chosen him to be the psychologist on his staff, and probably no one has done more to advance the cause of complementary alternative medicine than Dr. Weil, or perhaps should I say the team of Dr. Andrew Weil and Dr. Reuben Nyman. The thing that stands out for me most in this interview is his discussion of what he means by an energy medicine framework and his mother's three-question diagnostic system. What have you had to eat? How's your poop? And how are you sleeping? The way he's broadened those ideas into an energy framework makes conceptual sense to me. Broadly, what have you been consuming, taking into your body, your mind, your spirit? What have you been able to eliminate, discard, let go of that might be toxic to your body, mind, and or spirit? And finally, have you been practicing good sleep hygiene? And it's about this latter point that I plan to have Dr. Nyman back on the show at some point before too long. He sent me a PDF of his latest book, Hush, a Book of Bedtime Contemplations. As always, it's very rich and insightful. By the way, it's already out, and you can order yourself a copy by using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar.
Hello, David. This is Gloria Ullman from Adelaide in South Australia, and I'm coming out. Now, recently I made an extraordinary donation, or I prefer to call it a contribution, in addition to the one I usually make around December each year, and asked you not to mention it. But I've had second thoughts, and perhaps it just might inspire somebody somewhere, some way. So I'll leave it up to you whether or not you choose to play it. But the circumstances were that I recently had to have my 13-and-a-half-year-old Lilac Point Siamese cat, Chrissy, put down. And I had her cremated by the Animal Welfare League and obtained an urn with a tea light candle holder in the top of it and set up a shrine on her favourite elevated platform bed with a photograph and assorted artefacts of hers. And one day I lit the candle and I was just watching it and different things were going through my mind, and I thought I would really like to do something to commemorate her in a more concrete way. So I thought about the donation to the Animal Welfare League, but as I've been doing that for a long time anyway, it really didn't feel any different. And what I thought of then was the fact that she was and still is and probably will be for a long time the most frequent figure other than myself in my dreams. And that's when I got the bright idea of making a donation to the podcast in her memory. Now, I say that she was part human, but what she really represented to me was my inner child. And in loving her in the way that I did, and the very close bond that we had, I was able to heal a lot of the deficiencies in my own internal mother-child relationship. I'd never had children of my own by choice, and animals, and particularly cats, were substitute children for me, but it's only in the time that I've had Chrissy that I really began to fully appreciate the psychological benefits of companion animals. I was also inspired to make the recording by re-listening to the Frances Weller interview that you did, number 279, on grief, ritual, and the soul of the world. You mentioned it recently in an email that you read from Oscar, I think it was, in Sweden, where he said that it was one of his favourites. And I remembered that it had a big impact on me when I listened to it. So I went back and re-listened to it. So that gave me the impetus to go ahead and make this recording. So thank you so much, David, for all the work you do. And I really, really hope that you get the support that you need. And it's not just for you. This is a gift to the world. Thank you. I know this is a bit long, but I just re-listened to it before sending it and want to add another little bit. And that is that I said thank you, David, for the work you do. But really what I want to say is thank you for the person you are, because that has been as much of an inspiration as the actual education that I've got through the podcast. And in particular, the encouragement you have given me to do my dream blog. It was a dream that I had with you in it that really motivated me to do the blog. And I recently hit a wall with it, and you noticed and emailed me to encourage me to keep it up. So I have actually done that now and intend to keep on going with it. And I really regard it as my equivalent of Jung's Red Book. So thank you once again, David, finally.
Thank you, Gloria Ullman, longtime listener and very generous transcriber and financial supporter. I do hope others will be inspired by your words here. I know that I am. I'm afraid there are no new transcript announcements today. About 3/4 of our interviews have been transcribed by listeners such as yourself and the aforementioned Gloria. You can take a look at the transcripts page on our site, where all the transcripts and transcripts in progress are listed. Episodes that you don't see there need to be transcribed. Doing a transcript is another way that you can support Shrink Wrap Radio. And people who have done it tell me it's very rewarding, because as they re-listen, they get the content at a much deeper level. So drop me an email if you'd like to take one on. As I'm sure you probably already know from recent shows, I'm currently doing some advertising here for Audible.com, which I feel very good about because I've long been one of their customers, and like you, I love getting good audio content. I've got an Audible recommendation for you, and guess what? Once again, it turns out that today's guest, Dr. Reuben Nyman, has one of his books on Audible.com. Actually, I don't think it was ever published as a print book. Rather, it was always an audio book. The title is The Yoga of Sleep, Sacred and Scientific Practices to Heal Sleeplessness. It's narrated by Dr. Nyman himself, too. And by the way, his name is spelled R-U-B-I-N-N-A-I-M-A-N. You can listen to the whole unabridged audiobook by becoming an Audible.com subscriber. And you can do it for free. You can get this audiobook for free with no obligation to continue with other books by going to audibletrial.com/shrink. And if you're new to Shrink Wrap Radio, you might not be aware that we have an app for that. That is for listening to these shows and communicating with me. And you can find full details on our site under the Apps tab. Speaking of technical things, I've used a different microphone for today's show, and it's created some real challenges for me. It's an Audio-Technica ATR2100 dynamic mic. As a dynamic mic, it doesn't produce a very strong signal, and consequently, I've spent hours compensating for that with software fixes. I also think part of the problem may be it feels like I'm losing my voice. So that might be part of it. So I hope the listening experience has been satisfactory for you, my loyal fans. And I think I'll probably go back to the condenser microphone I had been using in recent episodes.
Hi, this is Jonathan Van Nuys, and you're on the couch with my dad, Dr. Dave.
Thank you, good son Jonathan. Now, since we are running a bit long, let me share just a couple of recent emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. The first one is from Dan, who writes, Dr. Dave, I've been following your show and the previous incarnation, Wise Counsel, for a little while. I listen to your interviews when mowing the lawn, taking walks at night, or snow blowing in the winter, and I'm often left feeling inspired and somehow more connected. I just listened to podcast number 416 and was really blown away by the material. I was especially excited to hear Dr. Kalshed talk about body-oriented psychotherapy. In my full-time job, I work solidly in the medical/psychiatric field, but I've been very involved in non-traditional modalities for almost 20 years now. I'm about to finish a 4-year training in bioenergetic analysis, which is a form of body-oriented psychotherapy, and in general, I feel like this area is not given much attention. I would be very excited for you to have more guests that have this approach. In fact, I just sent you a small check to show my appreciation and to encourage more on body-oriented psychotherapy. Thank you for providing this avenue of information and education. I've passed on your podcast to many colleagues and friends and will continue to do so. I have yet to find anything like it. Thanks again, Dan. Well, Dan, thank you so much for your enthusiasm and helping to spread the word, and thanks for your financial support. I'd be open to interviewing someone from the bioenergetics community. If you can provide me with a referral and contact info, that would be very helpful. I'm wondering, however, if you heard my interview with Stan Kellerman on episode number 317. I believe his own work has been strongly influenced by bioenergetics, among other somatic approaches. Next, we hear from Rich, who writes, Thank you, David. One humble suggestion for a guest would be Bonnie Badenoch. She is as graceful and articulate and inspiring as McGilchrist or Porges. Signed by Rich. Well, Rich, guess what? I've contacted Bonnie Badenoch, and she has agreed to be on the show. So you'll be hearing her here quite soon. And thanks for the suggestion. And finally, just one more short one, this one from longtime listener and supporter Dr. Michael O'Connor, who writes, "Hi, Dave, another recommendation for you. David Healy's Pharmageddon. This is an incredibly powerful book. I've heard David Healy speak before, and I strongly encourage you to consider interviewing him. He was hired by the University of Toronto while I was a resident in psychiatry there. His stand on the potential for antidepressants to increase suicide risk led to pressure from the pharmaceutical industry against him. His appointment was reversed. This book is exceptionally well-written and eye-opening. Warm regards, Michael." Michael, thanks for this suggestion. I was able to contact Dr. Healy in the UK, and at this point, I'm waiting for him to get back to me with a date and time that will work for us both. So there's something for us all to look forward to. So I think that better wrap up the email for today. Remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site, and you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. You can also leave voicemails using our iPhone/Android app, about which you can find full details in the Apps tab on our site. Thanks again to Dr. Ruben Nyman for sharing his vision for an integrative approach to mental health. My next episode will feature Ethan Nebelkopf discussing his work in the Native American community. Ethan is a personal friend going back to our graduate school days at the University of Michigan, so I hope you will join us. And once again, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.